Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We welcome back world-renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio. He'll answer your questions and listen to your comments, usually with a fairly open-minded sort of bent. And boy, it's fun to have Bob on the show. He writes for Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He's the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. His most recent book is The Sun's Heartbeat. It's on Little Brown. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Oh, but there are so many other ways that you can contact us, and I'm going to list them now. Are you ready? Here we go. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's one. You can post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, WAMC.org/VoxPop. That's two. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/WAMC Radio. That's three. Or you could tweet us your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. Oh, Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be here.
Nice to have you back on a beautiful Thursday. So I sent you a link a couple of days ago from our website about this really cool-looking storm on Saturn. What's the deal?
That's the planet of the hour. You know, just this past weekend, Saturn came closer to us than any time in the whole year, and it's at its best for the last 6 years, and it's the northern face tipped toward us. It's fairly easy to find in the sky, and Saturn is just plain amazing. It's just most people regard it as the most beautiful of all the planets. The storm is strange because there are high winds. Saturn has always had high winds, tornadic in ferocity, but that the entire hurricane is confined within a hexagon that sits atop the north pole of Saturn. Saturn's south pole doesn't have any geometric shapes, and why should there be a geometric shape where each arm of the hexagon, if that's the right term, is larger than the planet Earth? And inside this hexagon is this wild, amazing hurricane.
And it's directly over the North Pole then?
Yes.
And you know, the picture that was on, that's been widely distributed, but it was on our website, it was just bright red. Now, was that a false color?
False color, because they're using a Doppler equivalent to code the different wind speeds with that. Yeah.
What telescope took that?
I don't know. I suspect it was an infrared telescope, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, it was very interesting. Now, I mean, we've talked about this hexagon before. By the way, the number to call, 1-800-348-2551. You know, on the face of it, you say, well, that's an odd geometric shape to see in nature. But most scientists say, well, of course, it's a natural phenomenon, right?
Yes, because what is the alternative? The alternative is that aliens using slave alien labor built this giant sturdy hexagon that's persisted at least for the last 25 or 30 years, because the Voyager spacecraft, when it went to Saturn in 1981, also found it there, and it's still there. So it's kin to the great red spot of Jupiter, a long-lived, well, it's hard to say storm, because here's the story. It's 60 miles high. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away. It rotates at exactly the same rate that the innermost rocky interior of Saturn rotates. It has that kind of rotation. It's impervious to wind, because things like this hurricane and other winds that blow at 300 miles blow through this hexagon. So you say, what could cause it? Well, here on Earth, of course, we have snowflakes and we have other hexagonal natural things, but these are on tiny shapes, scales. And it's the scale that makes all the difference as to whether it's mysterious or not. For example, we're not surprised to see a little crystal that's a hexagonal or a little snowflake, but if we went outside and saw a perfect hexagonal cloud that were miles across and persisted for hours, we'd go, whoa, that can't be. Now, this is more than a cloud. This is something that could contain five or six Earths, and yet it continues. So why? The best guess is it's some kind of standing waves, the way we sometimes see over mountains, where a rotor wave or a lenticular wave forms because of the way the winds are blowing. But there are no structures or mountains or things that would cause a wave on Saturn. So you end up with a real puzzle. A few years ago, some researchers, I believe in Oxford, showed that if you take a rotating barrel of thick liquid like propylene glycol, with a disturbance at the bottom that's rotating at a different rate, you can create a liquidy standing hexagonal shape. But again, this is only a few feet across, and this is now we're talking about tens of thousands of miles across. So that's maybe a step in the right direction, but still mysterious.
So you mentioned that there's a rocky core, which I didn't even know. There's a rocky core. How big is that core in Saturn?
You couldn't possibly get there. Because
no, just how big is it?
Probably the size of Earth, which would be pretty small because Saturn has the mass of 95 Earths.
So if that's spinning in one direction or one speed, and the outermost gases are spinning another direction or another speed, then theoretically a very large hexagon could form.
Maybe. I mean, this is all guesswork. Nobody knows. I mean, as it is with all the outer planets, there are differential rotations, even with the Sun. For example, Saturn spins at 10 hours, 14 minutes at the equator, but takes 10 hours, 38 minutes as you get to higher latitudes.
Yeah.
Jupiter does the same thing. So different rates. The Sun does a different thing. It rotates at 25 days at the equator and over 30 at the poles. So we're used to a solid body like Earth where everything takes the same amount of time to make one
spin.
But
it doesn't really. That's an illusion as well, is it not?
Well, everything does take the same rate, but moves at different speeds in order to accomplish that.
All right. Well, frankly, I'm going with the alien slave hypothesis myself. All right, let's go to the phones. Bob Berman is our guest, 1-800-348-2551. And Tim in Boston Spa, you're first.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, I'd say, around dusk, I was looking at what I recall was a crescent moon, and there was something pretty bright next to it, so I put my telescope on it.
Jupiter.
Yeah, I figure four moons sticking out the side. Well, about 40 degrees or so off to the south was something else that was quite bright.
Sirius, the dog star.
Boy, it is bright.
Yes.
Okay, where do I see Saturn tonight?
Oh, Saturn. Now, to get to Saturn is not one of the brightest stars in the sky. It would be, if I had a guess off the top of my head, I'd say maybe the 8th or 10th brightest. So you want a bright star, but not the most brilliant star. Easy to find, actually, with just a little bit of work. You'd look straight overhead at 9 or 9:30, and there's the Big Dipper. Everybody can recognize the Big Dipper at this season. It's highest up at 9 or 9:30.
Uh-huh.
It's got a curving handle, so you follow the arc of that handle, and very famously, it arcs to the star Arcturus. To Arcturus, astronomy 101. Then you continue that arc downward, and then it'll get to two stars. The only stars that are down there in the southeast, the one on the right, that's Virgo's brightest star, Spica. It's bluish. The one on the left, that's Saturn.
Uh-huh.
So follow Big Dipper's arc of its handle downward. You'll pass a very bright star, Arcturus, an orange star. Keep going. You get to two stars down lowish. The one on the left, that's Saturn. A pointed telescope there, and you won't be sorry.
So I'm accustomed to, you know, the arc through the sky that all the planets seem to be on. It would be in that arc, right?
Yes, it's in the zodiac.
Yeah.
Yes, it's just on the border of Virgo and Libra. It's just on the Libra side of the
line.
What
do you figure the elevation of it will be this evening?
Well, if you look at 9 or 9:30, it's up about 20 to 25 degrees. If you can wait a little bit later to 11:30, it'll be up closer to 35 or 40 degrees, almost halfway up the sky.
My photographic tripod only goes up so far.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good luck, Tim.
I want to see those rings.
Well, thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We go to George in Northampton. George, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I hope it fits into the astronomy realm. I just read a book called How It Began by a guy by the name of Impey, which I highly recommend. It was a wonderful book on cosmology. And a lot of the book was about how when we look out into space, we're looking back in time via the Hubble and so on and so forth, which is great. I understand all that. What I realized reading the book, however, was I don't think I ever really understood why electromagnetic radiation moves in the first place. In other words, I understand that it moves at the speed of light, and I have a rough understanding of special relativity. But why do photons move at all? And if you can address that, that would be great.
Sure. And what you said is, of course, correct. Every time we look anywhere, we're looking back in in time. In fact, even here around the room, when you look at somebody who's 10 feet away.
Right.
Yeah, I left a few minutes ago, actually.
and if he were fast enough, Ray could have, because something that's 10 feet away, you're seeing it as it was 10 billionths of a second in the past, 10 nanoseconds in the past. So it always takes time for photons, that's the caller's question, to arrive. And so we're always seeing the past. It doesn't really get serious until we look at celestial distances, although this is what the GPS system is based on. The satellites that are 11,000 miles up send our cars or wherever our GPS units are time beeps, really, and our units in the car always realize that it's the wrong time. They get the time from three or more satellites and say, no, this isn't the correct time, because they know the right time. This is the wrong time. Wrong because it took some time for the signal to reach us from 11,000 miles. Knowing the speed of light and knowing the delay from three or more satellites lets it triangulate instantly and figure out where you must be to be that exact distance from three or more satellites. So the speed of light is absolutely used, well known, 186,282.4 miles per second. Why do photons move at this speed? Is, you know, whys are always tough, because the universe is built as it is, and we know now that a photon is a magnetic pulse that creates simultaneously an electrical pulse, so the two are creating each other. Electricity, magnetism, and the two energies.
I roughly understand what you're talking about,
yep. Yep, and they're propagating at right angles to each other, and will continue propagating on their own at that famous speed of light.
Right. So if I can sort of rephrase my question, interestingly, a moment ago when you were talking about Saturn, you were talking about standing waves. And so maybe another way to put my question is, okay, so why couldn't electromagnetic radiation in some interesting way or under certain circumstances form a standing wave? And what you seem to be saying, and everything I read,
why don't
you
tell us what a standing wave is.
It couldn't do that. Pardon me?
I was just going to ask Bob to tell all of us what a standing wave is.
Waves are funny things. For example, we see an ocean wave moving toward the beach. It seems to be moving forward. Surfers ride on it. But if you see what it's composed of, like a little bit of kelp or a cork that's in it,
it's going up and down.
That's right. It's going up and down. Nothing's really moving towards the ocean. The substance that makes up the wave is not moving forward at all. It's only oscillating.
But that's not
vertically.
True of electromagnetic radiation, right? The energy is moving.
That's right.
Because there's nothing moving up and down.
Hey, George, if you wouldn't mind, hang in there. We can let you finish up here, but I have to take a quick break. And
no problem.
All right, hang on. All right.
Zach,
why don't we put him on hold and do some business.
Support comes from the Urquell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Pure Photography, pictorial and modern photographs from the Syracuse University Art Collection, now through July 20th, urquellmuseum.org. Oblong Books, presenting Storytime with Randall DeSev, reading her book, Peanut and Fifi Have a Ball, Saturday, May 11th, 3 p.m. in Millerton. Oblongbooks.com. Richards Fuel and Heating, East Hampton, Massachusetts, providing high-efficiency gas and oil heating systems to the Pioneer Valley for over 45 years, now expanding into the Westfield area. RichardsFuel.com. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of Lake George. Hiking guides, events, and more. LGLC.org.
one 800 348 2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Bob Berman, astronomer extraordinaire, is our guest, and we have George in Northampton on the line. George, we'll get right back to you in a moment, but first, our producer Patrick Donges is here with something or other from some form of social media or other. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Pat.
Robert on Facebook asks, as a geologist with a graduate degree in paleontology, the evidence of major impacts and their aftermaths are evident in the fossil and geologic record. The impact on the Yucatan Peninsula was the end of the dinosaurs and the Mesozoic. Although little could be done to prevent an impact of that magnitude, is there any increased attempt to chart the orbits of bodies that may intercept our orbit, or should we just wait and see and hope we aren't next and have another beer?
I like that last part very much.
Me too.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, NEOs, near-Earth objects, are increasingly being charted and their orbits noted. That's happening more and more. And the proof of how well we're doing is that in this last year, we've never seen and detected more, and we're detecting more and more of them. However, what happened in Siberia a few months ago shows us that, especially if they come from a sunward direction, we're never going to get them all, yeah, especially when they're that size and you're not picking them up on radar. And so things can always come in and do damage. It wouldn't be that much of a stretch if we saw an orbit of something that was going to cross ours, like the object Apophis is going to be doing in the year 2029 and then again in the 2030s.
Great.
And it looks like it might hit us. It's not that much of a stretch to launch something and maybe nudge it out of its orbit. It might be a good idea.
Nudge it toward Venus. They got nothing going on. You know? All right, Patrick, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rick.
Appreciate it. All right, let's go back to George. George, are you there in Northampton?
Here.
Okay, so basically your question was why protons move in the first place, and we were talking about standing waves before the break. Maybe you can, in a minute or so, finish this up, Bob.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
fine. That's great.
Yeah, standing wave is simply sometimes you'll notice over a mountain or to the lee side of it, a wave that a cloud that persists, and that's because the wind itself is moving. See, this is almost the opposite of an ocean wave, where nothing is moving forward, although it looks like it's moving forward. Here, it looks like nothing is moving forward. That is, the cloud stays stationary, but the winds are actually going over the mountain, and then when they come down the other side, the water vapor condenses, and that's being carried over, and so you get a little bit of a cloud that's always there that seems stationary. It's called a standing wave. Looks like it's standing still. It persists. You don't want to fly a plane into
it. Okay. Well,
so I guess I would just leave it then. That I mean, I heard what you said before about why questions are always difficult, but it just seemed to me like the fact that photons move at all must say something about space-time and why it does what it does. And I've just never heard a good explanation of
why
they move in the first place.
nor have I. Of course, we humans ask the why questions all the time. Why do we spin at this rate and not at this rate? Why, you know, why do objects have the mass they do? And why is there always...
I hear you. Yeah. There's a million of these questions out there. That's true. Yeah.
Well, I guess you waited a long time for an unsatisfactory answer, George.
No, it's actually, I'm glad to hear somebody say we don't know why. I mean, it's great to know that
sometimes you can't
answer.
Why. Yeah.
It's very comforting.
Thanks a lot, George. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Let's go to, he seems satisfied. Let's go to Rick in Woodstock. Rick, let's go.
Yes. Hey, I think this one will be more straightforward.
Okay.
About a week and a half ago, like at 8 p.m., rising up was a beautiful, I think it was like a pink moon, and it came up at 8 p.m., and then at 10 p.m., I went out again to look at it, and it was just the regular, you know, nice full moon, but a yellow full moon. And is that a once-a-monther? And do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes, yes. Well, we did, during that full moon, on that night, that Thursday night, we had a partial eclipse of the moon. So the moon was actually going into Earth's, not umbral shadow, just a tiny, tiny little piece of it did, but penumbral shadow. So that gave it a little darkening that we normally wouldn't get. However, every single month when the moon is low, when it's just rising, we're looking through 14 times more air than when the moon is not much higher up than that. And any water vapor, any pollution, any dust in the air, we're looking at 14 times more. So all of this tends to have a reddening effect. Does it to the sun, too. That's why we get an orange or red sun at sunrise or sunset. And with the moon, the same thing. With the moon, it's a double-barreled effect. Not only is the moon always at least yellow, if not orange or red, when it's rising or setting, when it's low on the horizon, but it's also bigger. And it's the famous moon illusion that makes the moon and actually anything on the horizon, even constellations, look enormous.
I'm glad you brought that up because last week, I believe it was, whenever we had the last full moon, sitting at a spot where my son and I were at a ball field, and all of a sudden, the hugest moon of all time came up over
the
horizon.
That's the same night, I think, right?
My heavens, it looked enormous, but it's all in the eye of the beholder, eh?
It is, and the way you prove that is if you use a toilet paper or paper towel roll, an empty roll, and you look at the moon when it's low through that so that you don't see earthly objects near it, it'll look the same when it's lower, when it's higher. So you do need that juxtaposition between earthly objects, and that's what gives it apparent size. We see distant houses or chimneys or little church steeples, and then it gives it some size, whereas when the moon is high, it's only half a degree in size, and the hemisphere of the sky is 180 degrees. So the moon is only 1/360th of the span across the sky, and so it's dwarfed by the emptiness of the sky and looks smaller thereby.
It's amazing.
Well, Bob?
Yes.
On that one Thursday, that eclipse, is that a monthly thing?
No, that was the only one for this year that we'll see here.
But that's one per year?
That's for us. Some years we don't have any. Next year we're going to do a lot better on April 15th on tax day. We're going to have a total lunar eclipse that'll be visible from our area.
Oh, great.
Nice. Well, thanks for your time.
Rick, thanks a lot. Sure. We appreciate it. All right, let's go over to Assad in Poughkeepsie. Assad, you're on.
Hi, how are you guys doing? Hi, Dr. Bergman. Question, it's related to the photon question before. So I got the analogy with, like, seawater, waves propagate through it, the medium, you know, it looks like it's moving forward, but the actual, you know, kelp will stay in place. In the same way with a photon, like, it seems to be propagating itself in a direction. Can you say that the whole vacuum itself is vibrating? Because I remember, I'm a math physics major, but I remember in college someone mentioning something about a Kaluza-Klein theory from the 1920s where the guy was saying basically light is a vibration of the fifth physical dimension. I don't know if that makes any sense. And this is like a precursor to some of the super string stuff. And that was kind of my question. I still don't understand what light is, or I just don't get it.
Yes. Well, it really depends upon who's asking. Because light, if you do an experiment that looks for solids, then photons behave as if it's a massless solid. It always does when it's striking anything and when we measure it. When it's traveling, it's probably better to think of it as a combination of two waves, a pulse of magnetism and a pulse of electricity, rather than any kind of discrete solid object in a particular place. So it has both qualities, and perhaps even more amazing, we found that all objects in the universe, including the electrons in our bodies, all the solids have a energy aspect and a solid aspect. So it all depends on how you look at it or how you're looking, what kind of experiment you're doing. As for the emptiness that you were talking about, this becomes more and more intriguing with time. We used to think that space was absolutely empty. The ancient Greeks hated this idea. They disbelieved in emptiness because they were logicians. And to a logician, nothing can be empty because the word be, the verb to be, contradicts nothingness. You can't be nothing. And for people who believe that after death, I believe that you're just nothing. You can't say you are nothing because are and nothing contradict each other. It makes sense to say I'm going to walk, not walk. So you seem to be saying something, but you're not. So were they right? Well, it turns out yes and no, because we found that the emptiness of space ever since 1949 and the work of Casimir showed that empty space seems to seethe with unimaginable energy, which we now call a false vacuum or vacuum energy. More powerful than even anything that is propagating through it. And all the objects we see around us are just like little extra tiny little bumps or hills on this background powerful energy matrix, which makes up everything. There's a lot of talk both in New Agey false circles and in real theoretical circles of if there's ever a way to harness this vacuum energy, we would be freed from energy needs forever, because the energy, in theory, in an empty mayonnaise jar's worth of empty space, a mayonnaise jar of emptiness has the energy that could boil away the Pacific Ocean in 1 second, 1 second. And then it still wouldn't be depleted because it would rush in, more of it would rush in from elsewhere. So the vacuum energy is...
The other emptiness would rush in or something like that. It's interesting. Wow.
Yeah, so it would actually be limitless.
I like it. Thank you, Doc. Thanks. Appreciate it.
So what is it?
Well, I mean, nobody knows. You could get, you know, I live near Woodstock, and there we would talk about consciousness and the universe being correlative. In other words, the observer and nature are two sides of the same coin. John Wheeler, who won the Nobel Prize, physicist, absolutely not New Agey at all, would say that nothing is real unless it's observed. And so the consciousness of observation is needed to take anything from its probabilistic state. This is the work of John Bell in the 1960s, who said that even objects like protons and electrons that make up all the atoms around us don't really exist in particular places or have tangible existence or motion at all, except under observation. And then what he would call the wave function collapses and they become an actual object in an actual place. So except for observation, except for consciousness and us being here,
yeah,
the universe at best exists in a kind of potential or probabilistic state with this high energy, vacuum energy we're talking about.
The number to call, by the way, is 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question for astronomer Bob Berman, 1-800-348-2551. So how do you test something like that?
That's exactly it. And of course, saying something without testing it is the very reason why so many physicists pull their hair out over string theory, because it works on paper in the mind and there's no way to test it properly. In this case, though, there are several areas of evidence that this vacuum energy is real. One, Casimir found, and anyone can do this experiment, that if you hang two metal plates very, very close together, they will be pulled together with incredible force. The idea behind this is that the vacuum energy, like all other energies, have wavelengths, waves need some elbow room, some breathing room. So if you hang two metal plates very close together, the room inside the plates doesn't allow for the energy to fully express itself, whereas outside the plates, this vacuum energy, this potential energy is there.
But it only works with metal?
Metal shows it better, but you can theoretically use anything. And the fact that they're reliably pressed together, there's no other explanation except for this false vacuum that pervades everything. Also, the fact that ordinary helium, the most common form of helium, has no solid state, unlike every other element. It can never turn solid on its own. The theoretical reason for that is that the vacuum energy, quantum effects first, but also the vacuum energy, is preventing it from ever achieving this. In other words, there's a little bit of energy even at absolute zero. Even if you get down to the place where everything else freezes solid at minus 459.67 degrees Fahrenheit, that's where all motion stops. Mm-hmm. Motion and heat are two words for the same thing. When you go to the doctor, you could say, oh, I've had this fever, or you could say, oh, all the atoms in my body have been moving 3 miles per hour faster than normal all day. And he might say, here's some aspirin, this will slow them down. Because that's what aspirin does, slows down your body's atoms. That's all it is. Atomic motion, heat, two words for the same thing. So at absolute zero, all of this motion stops. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, helium should turn solid, but it doesn't. So that plus the Casimir effect are two good theoretical reasons why this false energy, or we call vacuum energy, is real, that pervades the universe.
Wow. Okay. There's liquid helium, right?
Yes.
So it just never progresses to...
Right. Liquid helium is very cool, too. You put it in a beaker, it just goes right up and scampers out like a lab rat just escaping, and it loses all resistance to flow. Superconductivity happens. Objects there can levitate, something called the Meissner effect. It's weird stuff on its own.
Very interesting indeed. Let's go back to the phones. Should we take a break? No, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Bill in Kingston. Bill.
Hi, Bob. I want you to know I'm a faithful reader of your column in the Almanac.
Thank you.
And An issue you've brought up twice in your column I have a question about. You reported that there's now evidence that the universe is infinite.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could explain in layman's terms what that evidence is.
Right. And once again, you know, to say something without at least good evidence for it is just kind of word stuff, and we hear too much of that already on cosmology shows and the like. So when we're looking for hard evidence about the universe as a whole, we use these days baryon acoustic oscillations, which essentially sound waves that propagate through the early universe. We compare type 1a supernovae with the redshift. We look at the Hubble constant, in other words, how the universe is expanding. We look at the topology of space, whether space-time shows a curvature, whether it's straight. These are all the areas of evidence for something like this. And you have to be careful because you could never prove infinity. You could prove if the universe were finite, you can't prove infinity. But more and more evidence since 1998 has been pointing that way. And last year, the team at the at Berkeley, surveying 900,000 galaxies, it's the largest ever large-scale survey looking as far into space as we can, shows that there's not the least bit of curvature to space-time. In other words, topology of space is totally flat out to the farthest reaches. Now, that can't be if the universe had were limited to the visible universe or the observable universe. In other words, the Big Bang and everything we can see or ever hope to see, if that were the universe, we'd see a very strong curvature. Instead, there is none. So that indicates, at minimum, the universe is about 100 times larger than anything we will ever be able to observe. In other words, we can't observe more than 1%.
Okay, that I never makes will. A lot of sense.
Right. But most cosmologists think that the Occam's razor solution, the simplest solution, is that the universe is infinite.
All right. We got to take a break here, and thank you, Bill. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. More with Bob Berman coming up.
Support comes from Carrie Haddad Gallery, presenting Color Theory, paintings by Paul Shushman and Urban, featuring works by seven photographers through May 26th. CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, arriving daily, flowering shrubs, roses, perennials, pansies, and violas ready for planting. WardsNursery.com. Saratoga Health and Wellness, a fitness facility offering exercise, nutrition, personal training, and weight loss programs. SaratogaHealthAndWellness.com. And Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry, and gifts. JoyellesJewelers.com.
Bob Berman Day on Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We go back to the phones. Dave in Wineskill. Dave.
Hi, guys. I love this show.
Thank you.
I have one question about photons when they're moving along. If they get affected on by gravity and their path is bent, do they lose any energy at all when that happens?
Yes, they are affected by gravity. They do lose energy,
go ahead.
The way it works is you then have to think of gravity not as an actual thing or force. You think of gravity rather as a local curvature or warpage in the space-time in the vicinity, which is how Einstein preferred to think of it anyway. So what happens is the photons traveling along in what's called a null geodesic, which is their path through this curved space-time, will follow a curved path. That's how Einstein said we could find out if he was right or wrong. And in May 1919, during a total solar eclipse in the constellation of Taurus, indeed, stars next to the sun were shifted from their expected position in just the way Einstein predicted, showing that, yeah, this thing really does bend it. And so it turns out that in that kind of a matrix, a photon is struggling against the gravity. It doesn't lose speed, but it does lose energy. In other words, it's redshifted.
It is redshifted.
Yes,
then.
Yes.
My question is, how do they, when they're looking out at when they use the redshift to figure out when everything is moving very fast away from us, how do they subtract? I mean, if these photons could be coming from so far for so long and they could be potentially redshifted, how do they subtract that from the redshift from the calculation of things moving away?
Well, it's an excellent question. There's an astronomer, Halton Arp, who just died fairly recently, who used to argue exactly that, that how do we know that, especially in some star clusters like Stefan's Quintet, which famously shows disparate redshifts. These galaxies are all at the same distance from us, and yet one of them shows a wildly different redshift. And he would argue that in cases like this, doesn't this mean the redshift is not caused by velocity or the expansion of the universe, because that would be true of all of these galaxies equally, but that some other factor like gravitational redshift or maybe even an unknown factor is responsible for redshift, in which case we can't trust it and the universe is not the size we think it is and all the rest. Well, it turned out that's gone away because one of those galaxies that seemed to be linked to the other with little tendrils of material proved to be a foreground galaxy when better telescopes such as Hubble looked at it and we were able to take better spectrograph images of it. And so those problems went away. So gravity, we see gravity in cases like when we're looking at a white dwarf star, which has a very strong gravity, and we see that it's gravitationally redshifted. But with an object like a galaxy, where we're looking at billions of stars, an aggregate of billions of stars, the expansion of the universe and the high speed is the overwhelming effect. And there are no local gravitational effects that would account for the redshift that we're seeing.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Now, photons have no mass?
Correct.
So things with no mass can be affected just by gravity, just like anything else?
Yes, by the warpage of space, like Roberto Duran used to say.
Roberto Duran said that?
He's the first one who said no mass.
Oh, very good. Hey, that was good. A boxing reference. I like it. Okay, we've dispensed with that. Marco in Kingston, you're on.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call, and good day, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. There's an interesting, Bob, you mentioned strange behavior at zero Kelvin and things like that, and I'm just wondering, is it possible to suggest that at temperatures that are extreme for us, that there may be forms of life in the universe that we couldn't even begin to imagine or recognize?
You know, once you say life that we couldn't begin to imagine or recognize, you've already set it up in a way that we don't know it. So you're saying, could there be forms of life that we don't know if we don't know it and can't recognize it? So it's sort of tautological, and I'd say, yeah, sure, the way you phrase that. But at 0 degrees Kelvin, that is minus 459.67 degrees Fahrenheit, at that thing, since all atomic motion has stopped, it means that all chemical processes have stopped. And so far as we know, life requires chemistry and, you know, biological functions, and all of these are motion related. So with absolutely no motion, with everything frozen, could you possibly have life? I don't see how you could, but then again, who knows? Universe always surprises us.
Right, and it's just interesting because it seems that we're always discovering new things that are telling us that there's so much more that we don't know. Anyway, thank you, gentlemen. Have a good day.
Good point. Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Andrew in Ballston Lake. You're on with Bob Berman.
Yeah, good afternoon. I read a book probably a year ago called One Second After. In the book, basically the premise was based on evaluation by the military of a possible situation where you have a magnetic pulse, electromagnetic pulse over like 25 miles up, somebody was to explode a bomb, and what would happen is it would ionize or crystallize in such a way that it would affect all the electronics in a certain area, like hundreds of miles possibly, to the effect where nothing with electronics would be able to be used.
They actually did that when they were exploding atmospheric bombs in the 50s. They had those problems.
Yep, EMPs are very well known.
Well, what happened is the guy who actually wrote the preface to the book, because the book was like a story, but the preface was based on an evaluation that the military was due to present the day of 9/11, the effects and what we should be aware of, such that we should be doing some things to counteract that possibility. And I was just curious as to that. I mean, they got this TV show now called Revolution, which is somewhat of a similar premise where all the electricity just gets knocked out. So I was wondering what your thought, just trying to learn a little bit more about that whole theory and if that's...
Well, that's outside astronomy, so I don't really know anything about
it. But I'll tell you what, there's a lot to be learned about electromagnetic pulse, and as soon as you type it into Google, somebody will be following you and tracking you from afar. So just be aware of that. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Jerry in Averill Park. Jerry.
My question has to do with the orbit of the moon around the Earth. What force or forces keeps that orbit going? And is there not danger that it might degrade and the moon crash into the Earth?
Actually, the moon's going the opposite way. The moon is going away from us at the rate of 1.5 inches per year. It's orbiting, it's spiraling away from us. What's happening is it's stealing energy from Earth's slowdown. You know, as we turn, the day is slowly getting longer. It's not very fast. At the end of a century, each day is 1/700th of a second longer after a century. But where does that energy go? Energy is never wasted in the universe. So the moon takes that energy and uses it to boost itself to a higher and higher orbit. And so it's actually spiraling away from it. So it's actually the opposite of what you're saying. But even if it weren't for Earth's slowdown, we wouldn't have to be concerned about the moon coming inward remaining in a stable orbit, because as Galileo showed us, this is a funny thing he did. He loved this stuff. He sent metal balls rolling down ramps, and he noticed that no matter how steep the ramp was, when he rolled down balls one ramp and then up another ramp, the ball always went as high up as the first ramp was released. So whether a ramp was gentle or steep, when you released a ball to roll down one and go up another, it would attain the same height, minus a little bit due to friction. And if you let it roll down a ramp and then go exactly horizontal, the ball would essentially keep going and only stop, he correctly concluded, because of friction. Then he suddenly realized, hey, the moon might be doing the same thing. In other words, the moon is falling down the ramp of gravity, but horizontally. And he realized that if nothing were in space, if it were a vacuum, an object would continue falling in a circle around us. It would never get closer, and therefore it would never need to increase its speed. It would never get further, and therefore it wouldn't decrease its speed. It would just keep going around and around forever. And since it takes the same energy to slow something up as speed it up, this would just be a forever situation. That's why the planets go around the sun forever, and so does the moon around the Earth.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Jerry, thank you. It's 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And let's see, I think we lost Rosie in Albany. Let's go to Ed in Salt Point. Ed.
Yes, this is just following up on the infinity, and as a matter of fact, the forever that was in the last question. We don't really have time to discuss this in detail, but infinity is a negative concept. It's an operational concept. It's therefore outside of pure mathematics, not subject to, you know, the ordinary logical understanding of Hawking's razor. So, Bob had said earlier that by Occam's razor, because we cannot determine a boundary, I'll use that language for a moment, for the universe, by Occam's razor, let's assume it has none. That would be, as I say, an illegitimate application of Occam's razor in logical terms.
All right, let me answer it this way. All the cosmologists I spoke to, because we did a major piece in Astronomy Magazine about this and about infinity, all of them thought that the simplest explanation for the data from the Berkeley team is not that the universe is at its minimum value, which is 100 times larger than the visible universe or the observable universe, but that the universe is infinite. They all believe that. Now let's see what that means. Now, you brought up logical, non-logical. And you're absolutely right, because once you get to infinity, and assuming that there's the same mass energy distribution beyond the observable universe than in the observable universe, and I grant that that's a big assumption, but let's assume that it is, it would mean that the that there's infinite galaxies. And also, since you can't get infinity from a finite point in the past, it also strongly suggests that the Big Bang was just a local event in the hood. It was not the start of the universe, but just a local event in the visible or observable universe. And so what are we left with this in terms of logic or non-logic? Let's be honest and say that all along, we've had a non-logical universe, in that if you subscribe to the Big Bang, people say, well, what preceded it? What caused it? You can't have the whole universe popping in out of nothingness. You can't get a universe from nothing. So what caused it? Since we don't know the answer, it's clear that you could keep going earlier and earlier and earlier and never reach a conclusion about a birth, because you could always picture something that must have caused that. So you have a universe that from the start is not amenable to our symbolic or dualistic system of math, science, logic, rational mind. We work by symbolism. You know that. The word water is not actual water. We work by using components and then seeing how they fit into the whole. And taken as a whole, which is what cosmology is, trying to picture either the Big Bang and what preceded it, or not a Big Bang, not a finite universe, but an infinite universe, you can't picture that either. You can't picture eternity, which doesn't mean time without end, doesn't mean limitless time. It means no time at all.
Okay.
Can we picture no time? Can we picture any of this? And none of this is logical. None of this is rational.
I can picture running out of time.
And oh, okay.
Ed, thanks a lot. I appreciate
it's
the call.
It's a great idea.
So when you use Occam's razor, do you need shaving cream? Let's go. Let's get another call in here real quick. Mike in Rhinebeck. Mike, you got a couple of minutes.
Oh, great. So the discussion earlier about the redshift of photons in space-time gravity warp, as I was thinking about that, I was trying to understand, is that a relative shift in that the photon slows down as it moves through that curved space relative to where you're standing? So there would be a place where its energy level increases depending on where you were looking at it?
The energy does increase if a photon's coming toward you. One way to think of it is that you're intercepting more of the pulses, because every color has a certain number of pulses per second. For example, green light has, if I remember correctly, 550 trillion pulses per second. If it's coming toward you, you're going to see more pulses per second, and that's going to give more energy or blue the light. So objects coming towards you are going to be blue-shifted. Objects coming away from you will be red-shifted. Since red light has less energy than blue light, it's a weakening of the energy. It's an actual physical dimming or weakening of the energy when an object is either going away from you or escaping a gravitational field.
So it's a Bernoulli effect of light.
No, not Bernoulli effect. That's something entirely different. That would be the difference between pressure on one side of an object than another. Different phenomenon.
Okay, but I understand. In terms of the pulses, I was thinking about sound waves and how they speed up when they're being pressured. I get it. Okay.
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot. Hey, you know, Rosie in Albany, we lost you earlier. I'm sorry to say you have about 30 seconds to pose the question. Bob has about 30 to answer. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi. I was wondering if you could elaborate on how there can be energy in a vacuum, because my understanding is that energy comes from molecules, movement, something like that.
Okay.
Well, energy is, you know, people use the word energy for a lot of things. Heat energy is the movement of atoms and molecules. That's what we call heat. Yeah. And yes, that's a substance. You wouldn't have that in a vacuum. But there are energies that pervade the vacuum. One of those is the electromagnetic energies of magnetism and electricity and light, pulses of light. When we shine the lights that are in the studio right now, if we were out in the vacuum of space, if there's no air between us, there'd still be this energy traveling. It does not need a medium in order to propagate from one place to another. So no, you don't need anything for energy to get from one place to another, unless you're talking about the energies of motion, which is kinetic energy. So you're right about kinetic energy, but not about electromagnetic energy.
Very interesting.
Thanks, Rosie.
Thank you.
So we only have 10 seconds left, but I thought you had said earlier that because of dark matter and dark energy, that there may not be real vacuums anyway.
Yeah, but I make this stuff up.
Well, on that happy note, we leave you, my friends, and tune in again next time as Bob makes more things up. Support for WAMC comes from Don Muller Gallery, Northampton, Massachusetts, specializing in jewelry, custom designs, handcrafted glass, and gifts by American artists since 1978. Facebook and DonMullerGallery.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, providing legal and consulting services to life insurers in a changing regulatory climate, currancompliance.com. And Wiawaka, Lake George, New York, an enrichment and revitalization historic lakefront retreat created by and for women since 1903, wiawaka.org for events. Thanks to you for calling in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Thanks to the great Bob Berman. Thanks to Zach Malloy, equally great, but in a different field. And thanks to our Matt Don Diego. Alan calls him Zorro. We just call him Matt. He answered the phones. Our producer, Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow in this hour, it's Moyers & Company. On Monday, Alan is here for Medical Monday. Stay tuned for a news update.